I'm Ron Barr, and welcome to this special World Airways in-flight presentation of Sports Byline USA. Sports Byline is America's sports talk show and is heard on more than 200 U.S. radio stations, Sirius satellite radio, as well as worldwide on the Internet and the more than 500 stations of the American Forces radio network. Sports Byline has been called the Nightline of Sports for its insightful, human, sometimes humorous, and certainly always interesting interviews with the biggest names in sports. On this special in-flight presentation of Sports Byline USA, we'll talk basketball with B.J. Armstrong. Armstrong won three NBA championships during the Chicago Bulls dynasty years. Pat Williams will also join us. Williams is the co-founder of the NBA's Orlando Magic. His book, Chicken Soup for the Soul, Inside Basketball, is filled with inspirational stories about the impact the sport has had on the character of the country. And we'll also remember the man they called the genius, the late Bill Walsh. His son, Craig Walsh, has authored a book about his dad called The Score Takes Care of Itself. So sit back and enjoy this special in-flight presentation of Sports Byline USA. First up, B.J. Armstrong. Armstrong came out of Detroit, and growing up, the Pistons' Isaiah Thomas was his childhood hero. But it was the Pistons' nemesis, the Chicago Bulls, who drafted Armstrong in the first round after an outstanding college career at Iowa. His timing was perfect. He joined a Bulls team that had Michael Jordan, Scottie Pippen, and Dennis Rodman. He became the outside shooting threat that helped Chicago win three straight NBA titles in the early 90s. He went on to play for three other teams before coming back to Chicago to finish his career. We started by talking about the end of his career. I told him that I had remembered an athlete that had told me he started preparing for his retirement the first day he started playing. And I asked Armstrong if he took the same attitude.
Well, you know, actually I did. When I went to college, I had the opportunity to study in communication. I always had an interest in the media. And so I always kind of I enjoyed the process of being interviewed and how the questions. And it was always fun to play in the game and then to see how the game was written about and talked about and things. So I've always had an interesting perspective, one with respect and looking about it. And I always thought someday I would get into the media, and here I am having the opportunity, and it's just been it's been terrific thus far.
And you know, BJ, as well as I do, that's not, generally speaking, the attitude that most athletes take toward the media. It's somewhat adversarial to some degree. Maybe it's because they don't understand it. Maybe because they haven't been exposed to it. Why do you feel you had a different attitude toward it, and what, generally speaking, do you think is an athlete's attitude toward the media?
Well, when I was in college, I always had the idea of, you know, how you think things are always different from how things really are. So, you know, what you think is going on is always different from how it really is.
Perception and reality. Yeah,
perception and reality. And I always was just kind of always intrigued by that that idea. So it's always intrigued me to actually play the game, be around the guys, be in the locker room, prepare for the game, and then see how it's portrayed in the media. And so to me, that idea just always kind of carried. It was kind of curious. In many regards, and more importantly, I always wanted to portray the truth, or how I saw it and how it was really done. So it was just a very interesting thing that I always pursued. I was always kind of aware of as a player, so it just really kind of stuck with me. So here I am, and it's really interesting to see how things are, and then how the things are written about, talked about, and analyzed and critiqued throughout the media.
What is the fear factor that athletes have with the media, you think?
Well, I think a lot of it stems from the, first of all, the ability to communicate. I think there's a way that athletes communicate with themselves in the locker room, their comfort zone, whether it's with coaches or their close friends. And then all of a sudden you have people that come in and communicate with the media. Even though you may be discussing the same thing, I think there's a breakdown of words, how they are, how they relate to the words, but more importantly, how it's interpreted. So many times coming after a game, I 10 minutes after a game, I think that's the time that was allowed back when I played, a media comes in. 10 minutes after the game, you really haven't gathered yourself. You still have this high from the game. You're still kind of gathering yourself, whether, you know, you're going to another game, a road trip, you're getting yourself ready, and all of a sudden you're here answering questions in depth, something that happened 2 hours ago. So a lot of times it's just, you know, anyone who's played or had worked in a strenuous physical activity, all of a sudden you're coming into a mental aspect where you got to communicate, gather yourself, gather your thoughts, interpret the words. I think it's a very difficult transition for a lot of athletes, and a lot of times the two just don't mix at that exact moment because, you know, guys have deadlines, guys have to meet things, and a lot of times the players are just really trying to move on to the next place. And so a lot of times I see the conflict and I see why it's there.
Do you think, BJ, the fact that athletes are fragile, I mean, you're evaluated on a moment-to-moment basis in your business, the playing business, the sports business, and the criticism that comes from people that maybe have not played the game at that particular level, does that factor into the reticent aspect of the athlete not wanting to deal with the media, you think?
Well, I think one of the things as an athlete that I've learned, and it's been very helpful now that I'm working in the media, as an athlete, you're very aware of the perpetrator-victim model. And what that means is there's always someone to blame during the game. So, you know, a player will have a beautiful game. He'll, you know, play exceptionally well, and then he'll miss that final shot. And all of a sudden, now he's the scapegoat. And you totally forget about the other, 46 minutes that he played. You just remember those last 2 minutes where he couldn't make a shot or he missed the shot that could have won the game for his team. So I think that victim model is one that an athlete is always aware of, because an athlete on a game-to-game, a day-to-day, he must perform. And not only perform for his team, he must perform in front of the millions of fans throughout the world. And so I think he's always aware of that. And a lot of times, these athletes seem invincible. They seem tough. They have this persona. But you know what? They're human. And I think that's what's forgotten many of times, and that these athletes do care. These athletes are trying their best. These athletes are doing the very best they can. But like many of us do in life, you know, the only way you can learn is from experience. And the only way you're going to do that is through trial and error. You know, if we knew what to do, we would do it. But a lot of times you have to go through the steps, the process, and that's always painful. But once you get over the fact and you learn that it's an impersonal experience, I think it makes it very enjoyable. And one, I just said, you know what, I'm going to make mistakes. I might as well enjoy making my mistakes, but correct them as quickly as I can.
You know that you are very, very rare, because most athletes don't take that approach. I think one thing that's not fair to the athlete, BJ, is that the industry has changed a great deal. If you're with the beat writer of a team, they know a little bit of the history. They know what's happening. But there are so many members of the media coming from the internet now, coming from television, coming from radio, and invariably there's going to be that stupid question, you know, like, how long have you been a black quarterback? That sort of thing. I really think that the athlete feels gun-shy and fearful that whatever they say, particularly if it's in the written media, is going to be taken out of context.
Well, it is. And, now I'm getting an opportunity to see it from this side. And, you know, you do – I've been playing basketball my entire life. And my whole life I've been around basketball to some extent, whether I was playing or coaching or working in the front office, viewing the game now from the media. And then I suddenly realized when, working and doing the things I'm doing in the media, when you cover a variety of sports, basketball, baseball, you can't put in the effort and the energy to know the details of that sport. So you're talking more in general terms. And these players are more specific. These players are really experts in this field. So a lot of times they do get gun-shy because the patience, it's almost like you feel at some point or some time that it's a disrespectful question where the person asking the question is not being disrespectful. They just, I don't know your profession, you don't know my profession, and I don't want to offend you. You really don't want to offend me. So you both kind of do this dance with one another that you're really not trying to hurt one another's opinion, hurt one another's feelings. And a lot of times it has to do with, just the inexperience of both. The player, this is only his second or third year in the league. A lot of times you have young people that are just getting started, kind of want to make a mark for themselves. So it really boils down to really feeling comfortable, knowing the questions to ask, knowing when to ask the tough question, and also knowing the person that you're dealing with so that you can get the correct answer and get accomplished what it is you're trying to get accomplished.
And there's another aspect to it, and I've said this when I speak around the country. I said, if you go up to an athlete and say, bases were loaded, ninth inning, why did you choke in the ninth inning? You're not going to get an answer. You're probably going to get slugged, maybe.
Yeah,
but if you say to him, in that ninth inning situation with the bases loaded, what went through your mind?
Yeah,
you're going to get an answer to that question.
Yeah, and you know what? One thing, no matter what the situation is, how much money these guys make, how much press they get, whether good or bad or indifferent, is that these guys are really doing the very best they can. And I think that's the one thing that has really been lost in sports, is that I have yet to have met any player of any professional basketball, baseball, football, hockey that didn't go out there with the intent to do the very best they could. I haven't met a player that said, I'm just going to go out there and screw up. And that is very, very key. Even though you go out there and you make mistakes, You know, most of us don't, you know, when we do make a mistake, we don't just make them in front of millions of people, unlike these professional athletes. So they're trying their best, but unfortunately, you don't always do your best. And many of the players that play that don't have the skills to really recognize that and be able to articulate that way, where they come out being humble and with humility when you do make a mistake.
Yeah, that's where I was going next. Is there a racial and socioeconomic overtone to the relationship between the media and the athlete because of the fact that maybe if it's a minority athlete, they have not been exposed to certain things that give them a comfort in this area?
Well, that brings me back to when I first went to I grew up in Detroit, Michigan, and I remember I had the opportunity to go to a Catholic high school. And when I went to Catholic high school, which was out in the suburbs of Detroit, that was kind of, it was a new world to me. Growing up in the inner city, knowing one lifestyle, growing up in that culture, and then being exposed to a different culture was, you know, the way you communicate, the way you conduct yourself, the way you learn different things, different meanings. So I think a lot of times, once you get into this lifestyle, you know, you go from, you know, many of these players are going from high school to the NBA. Where's the transition? Where do you, you know, you don't just take a kid from like algebra and throw them right into, you know, and calculus and just say, you know, function. So, you know, you just have to, there's a process there. And many of these players don't get into the process, the graduation of going from step one, step two, to they get to step 10. They go right from high school right to the NBA and then say, and throw them in there, and we expect these kids to function, which they're not. They're 18, 19, and no matter how they may look on the outside, you know, they're still 18, they're still a kid at heart. And like I said, if you don't have the experience, you're not going to know what to do. And many of these players just don't have the experience that that many of us have who are happen to be older in life.
B.J. Armstrong is with us, played 11 years in the NBA, 3 championship rings with the Chicago Bulls, and we'll get to that aspect in his life. You heard him allude to the fact that he grew up in Detroit, and you grew up in the inner city. And for a lot of people, particularly white people, they don't know what that life is like. Give us some insight of what inner city life is like for a young kid.
Well, you know, having the opportunity to grow up in the inner city in Detroit, and then all of a sudden being thrust into a lifestyle which financially allowed me once playing professionally, there really isn't any difference in the lifestyle. I think many of us grew up, no matter whatever your social or economic situation, you grew up asking the question, who am I? And, you know, you kind of grow around and you say, well, what's my purpose? What am I going to do? Why? You know, people are asking questions. But when it's all said and done, having the opportunity to live in many places throughout this country, having the opportunity to share in the world, it boils down to everyone wants to have peace and everyone wants to be happy. And consciously, you make your own choices the best way to get you there. But really, there is no difference between none of us. I think economically we can make a case and make that point. But when it all boils down to, I have many of friends who are millionaires many times over and are just as unhappy as the person who has absolutely nothing, and vice versa. I mean, you can have nothing and be just the happiest person on the planet and the other way around. So I think it boils down to everyone wants to be happy. And then you have a choice. You learn where that happiness stems from, and I think you go from there.
There are certain things, certainly in the inner city, that are important, and basketball certainly is in the inner city. Tell me about the basketball game in the inner city, because one of the best memories I ever had in Washington, D.C., was going out on a summer evening, 95 degrees, 95% relative humidity, and watching 10 guys, shirt and skin, play when the sun had gone down, blacktop basketball.
Well, it's great, and my fondest memories are playing growing up in Detroit, playing on the playgrounds, and I always remember with the, you know, growing up as a kid, you play with the older guys if you're good enough. That was kind of like the greatest thing ever, and any kid growing up will say if the older guys in the neighborhood pick you up, that's better than anything. And I never forget one of the guys told me, he said, if you happen to get to the NBA, this game here will be the biggest game that you'll ever play in. And I never forgot that. Even when I played in the NBA Finals, I remember thinking that I didn't understand it then, but I understood it once I played in the NBA Finals. Because everything that, who I was, where I was at, I couldn't leave that environment and then go somewhere else. If I didn't come out there and compete in that environment every day and give my best, I couldn't go anywhere else. So I had to find out who I was, what kind of player I was going to be and be able to perform amongst my peers and the people that I live with. You know what? If I miss a shot in a game, I can go home. I can look at tape. I can break it down. I could go work on. But I can always get away from that. There's an off season. But growing up there, he said these would be the biggest games you're ever playing. And I never forgot that. And that just made me feel so confident playing in the NBA because I knew I had played in bigger games. I knew I had played amongst my peers. I knew I played against the people that knew me, knew who I really was. And it just wasn't, you know, I wasn't coming into someone's home for 2 hours or someone was just watching me for the very first time. And whenever I see those people that I grew up and all my friends back in Detroit, you know, I always, you know, I have the most respect for them because they knew something that you can't teach. And that was the love and the respect for yourself and knowing who you are and finding out who you are before you actually get to a point where someone tries to tell you who you are.
One of the things that I heard from Benoy Benjamin, who grew up in the inner city in New York, was he said that if there was a kid that had great talent, that those elements in the community there made sure that they were protected. In other words, that nothing happened to them. They knew that they could go on and beyond the inner city, that the drug dealers, the pimps, and others like that would say, hey, the word on this kid is a good kid. He's got some talent here. Nothing happens to him. Was it like that in Detroit as well?
Well, you know what? Contrary to what you see in the media and you read, there's a lot of love in the communities throughout this world. And that's the one thing I've been very fortunate to travel, and there is a lot of love out here that really, I mean, we make all these cases, bad places here. You know what? People are amazing, and wherever you go in this world, wherever you go in this country, there's a lot of love there. And when you see people that have an opportunity to do something positive in a community, it's really amazing how somehow a young man against all the odds in the world will, or a young woman for that person, or anyone, will find a way to get it done. So the spirit that lies within all of us is just amazing. Once a person has the courage and the determination to do what it is they set out to do, it's just an incredible feeling. And anyone who's had an opportunity to really figure out who they are and pursue it with that much courage, they'll tell you there's nothing going to turn that person back. You know, I had a friend of mine who I grew up with. You know what? We're talking about great players and great people in the world. And I never forget, he said, and he uses this, and I have no idea where this came from. He said, nothing was going to stop Picasso from being Picasso because he was going to be that no matter what. And that's the type of attitude you got to have if you want to be a professional basketball player. So these are the things that you grow up with in the inner city. These people aren't like professors. These people aren't like Harvard graduates or Yale or you know, Cal Berkeley.
Streetwise.
But these people have wisdom beyond that you just can't read in a book. And that's what I learned, and that's why I feel so fortunate to grow up where I did in Detroit, because there's this wisdom out there that really somehow you just like to share with everyone.
Let me ask you why some of the legends on the playgrounds, no matter where that might be, never make it into professional basketball. I know talking to Chris Mullin one time about that, because he came off the playgrounds as well as in New York, and Al Addles, I asked him about that, and he said that there wasn't the discipline to play the professional game. They didn't know how to play roles. They were great in a freelance situation, but they really couldn't take that game off the playground and put it into a professional environment.
Right. Well, you know, I think many players, the best players, I think anyone who's played in the NBA will say the best players don't play in the NBA. The best players they're walking around in all these places throughout the world, you know, saying coulda, shoulda, woulda. I mean, there are some great players, and I certainly was not I wasn't the best player to coming out of Detroit, but I just was very fortunate to make it. And then looking back on it, and one of the reasons that I did make it is I just happened to be in the right place at the right time. And there are certainly players just as good or better than me, but in order for anything to be what it is, for me to be the best basketball player I was going to have to be in the right environment and have the right opportunities come along at the right time. And I was very fortunate that those things came for me. A lot of players, you know, they have commitments, whether, you know, they couldn't go to school because maybe they had to work, or maybe they had a child, or maybe, you know, they had an injury, or something may have happened that they didn't have the same choices in front of them that I had. So I just happened to be in the right environment at the right time in the right place to be a basketball player, and that's the best way I can put it. So I don't put anything of saying of I did this, I did that. I just feel very fortunate to be in the right place at the right time. And what I did do is when I did have the opportunities, I did the very best I could in those situations.
B.J. Armstrong, a champion on the court and now a success off of it. Pat Williams is a basketball man through and through. He's a co-founder of the Orlando Magic and its senior vice president. Off the court, Williams is a family man in a big way. He has 19 children, including 14 adopted children from four nations. He's captured his love for basketball with his book, Chicken Soup for the Soul, Inside Basketball. The book is a collection of stories of character-defining and inspirational experiences from today's NBA superstars and coaches. I asked Williams, what was the motivation for putting this book together?
Well, Ron, the Chicken Soup people have turned out books on every topic over the last 17 years, over 200 of them, but they never had gotten to the basketball version of Chicken Soup. So 2 years ago, they asked me to do it, and I accepted. Little realizing the amount of work and the churning through stories it would take, trying to find those stories that bring a goosebump or get the hair on your arm standing up or bring a tear or a chuckle or touch your heart in some way. The end result is 101 of these stories. I think each one delivers a pretty powerful message. And the thing that was interesting, Ron, there were 15 stories beyond that that I just could not let go of. And fortunately, the editor said, okay, we'll create a bonus section. They're going to get an extra serving of soup here, and we were able to tuck those other 15 in as well.
Pat, you've done a lot of books about sports. What did you find about basketball that maybe you did not know when you started this effort?
Well, it's a universal language, Ron. You know, it's far beyond just a bouncing of a ball and a net and a hoop. It's a profession, or it's a sport, it's an activity that brings people together. It teaches leadership, it teaches teamwork, it teaches perseverance, it teaches hard work, it teaches taking the bad breaks in life and battling through them and overcoming them and turning them into strengths. I think that's what I learned, that this, and made me feel good, because I've spent almost 41 years in professional basketball now, Ron, and sometimes you do think, is it really worth it, or what have I contributed anything that of lasting value? And in putting this book together, it really focused me and got me to thinking that basketball is far beyond a sport. It's really a whole life lesson issue, and that's really what I came away with.
I know you were a college catcher and played in the minor league systems for a while before you jumped over to the basketball side, so you certainly know the other sports pretty well. Is there something about basketball that makes it unique and different from the other sports?
Well, it's our sport, Ron. It's the American sport. That was started right here in our country by Dr. Naismith with a specific set of rules. And, I mean, we know it the exact day and the exact location when the sport was started. Whereas with baseball, there are 18,000 theories of how it all started, and probably the same with football. So, first of all, it is our sport. It's an American sport, and we've exported it around the world. But there's just something about the intimacy of the game. I went to a high school game last night, Ron. I hadn't seen a high school game in years. Winter Park High School in Winter Springs, tournament game, with 15-year-old Doc Rivers' son, Austin, who's a phenom. I mean, a phenom at 15. And I looked at him and said, how did that kid get so mature? And he looks like a 25-year-old NBA player. And I thought, well, basketball did it. Obviously, he's got good bloodlines, but basketball did it. I mean, it's a teaching sport. You learn how to grow up real quick in this game.
One of the things that I like about this book, you mentioned about the 101 great hoop stories from players, coaches, and fans as well, is it really covers a complete spectrum and different decades and different eras of the game. Is there a commonality that you found over those different eras about the game and about the stories that are told in this book?
Well, that's a great question, Ron, because, you know, we've got stories in there from Dolph Schayes and Bob Pettit, and a story about Tom Heinsohn, and there's some Coach Wooden stories from way back, and then you go right up to the modern era. I think it covers all age spans. I think it covers all geographical spans. It covers all economical spans. It just covers the waterfront, and to read the lessons that a Bob Pettit has for us, or a Dolph Schayes, listen, you can take them. They happened back in the 1950s, but they're every bit as pertinent and applicable today.
I think you know as well as I do that basketball is something that I think is unique from a cultural standpoint, because it's dominated by African-American players. And so, therefore, I would think that the stories and the perspective of African-American athletes and coaches toward the game might be different than what it might be for the white player or the white coach. Am I correct in that assumption?
Well, that's a good question, Ron, and we obviously have some wonderful stories from African-American stars and tough times that they've come through. For example, the Caron Butler story. I mean, here's a young man growing up who served prison time. You know, he was locked away. Could have been just another statistic, but it was that time in prison that really got him to thinking about what he wanted to do with his life and how he wanted to overcome that. And, of course, he went on and got out and got himself straightened out, went to the University of Connecticut, has become an outstanding NBA player. I was greatly inspired, greatly touched by that. And then you've got a Julius Erving story told by Phil Jasner, the Philadelphia writer, and the impact that Julius had on his family. And Sam Smith tells the Michael Jordan story. And then, of course, we've got, Ron, the book starts with the Jim Jones Jr. story right out in San Francisco. You know, the son of Jim Jones of People's Temple fame, you know, of Kool-Aid fame. And then Jim Jones tells his story about what basketball's meant to his life. Powerful stuff.
You mentioned about the Michael Jordan story. Relate that to us.
Well, Michael, Sam Smith, the celebrated Chicago Tribune writer, told that story about it was the playoffs. And right in the middle of the game, or right before the game, big playoff game, they bring in some crippled children to speak and spend some time with Michael. And Michael ends up right before the game, you know, dealing with these crippled kids. And it was so powerful that Sam's ends up in tears. Sam is wondering, how in the world is Michael Jordan going to go out and play after this emotional encounter with these handicapped kids? And he went out and got about 45 that day against Atlanta on Easter Sunday and just tore their hearts out. The lesson being, this gracious, kind, generous soul, Michael Jordan, out in between the lines, Ron, you know, he'll just carve your heart out.
Yeah. My favorite Michael Jordan story was shared with me by the late David Halberstam when he was in the studio because, as you know, he wrote a book about Michael Jordan, and he told the story about the time when the team was traveling on a United flight up to Portland, and that was at a time where they didn't have the charters. They were going commercial airlines, and so as they get into Portland, because the ground crew knows Michael being an African-American icon, they come on board the aircraft to meet him. And so anyway, Michael proceeds to talk to the ground crew, and he sees Michael giving money to the ground crew and everything, and the PR director says, no, I'll take care of the ground crew and for the bags and everything, no problem. And Michael said, no, don't worry about that. Well, they work their way to pick up their bags at the carousel, and on the carousel there is a wad of money, probably about $5,000. And so all of a sudden the bags come out, Michael walks over, picks up the money, and the PR director says, "What was that about?" He says, "Oh, I bet the other players on the team my bag would be the first one off the plane."
Yeah, he was a competitor, boy. And you want to know one of my favorite, and it's in line, Ron, with the death of Larry Miller, the longtime owner of the Utah Jazz. But he loved the game, loved his team, and he would sit on that front row, you know, and get on the refs, get on the players. And one night he was taunting Michael Jordan for dunking on one of his guards, a little guy, and he's riding him. So Jordan steals the ball, dunks on that seven-footer from Kentucky, Mel Turpin. Remember Dinner Pail Mel?
Sure.
He dunks on the seven-footer, runs by Larry Miller's seat and says, "He big enough for you?"
You know, one of the things that I love about sports is that they tend to lend themselves to telling great stories. Now, I know that Willie Mays said to me one time he laments the fact that baseball players don't tell stories, and he says he thinks it's the money that has something to do with that. But I don't think that that's the case in basketball. Why is it? Why are there so many great stories about basketball?
Well, Ron, and I'm not sure Willie's really correct on that. I am stunned with all athletes, and baseball players included. They don't forget anything. I mean, Robin Roberts, the great pitcher, is, I guess, 82, 83 now. If you sit with Robbie over lunch, he will tell you every pitch, every count, every batter, every incident, everything that anybody ever said to him, everything about every game he ever pitched in. And because it's just so defined in his mind. I think with basketball, the sport is so intimate, Ron. I mean, these guys are, they live together. First of all, in the NBA, they're not separated from each other for 8 months. and in tight quarters, and the game is packed in between those lines, so it's there, it's right in front of you, you hear everything, you see everything. And here's something else. Basketball players are running around out there with half their clothes off. Keep that in mind. I mean, football players, nobody recognizes them. And in baseball, I went out and saw the Astros and the Nationals Grapefruit League game. You know, they're all covered up. You never see their faces. But in basketball, I mean, they're right there in front of you, and they're in a state of half undress.
Pat Williams has joined us on Sports Byline. Again, we're talking about the book, Chicken Soup for the Soul, Inside Basketball. I'm sure there are some tearjerkers in here. Tell me a couple of your favorites.
Well, I'll tell you, when I said one of the things we did, Ron, to get 101 stories, I knew it was going to be a numbers game. And so we sent out, we must have mailed out 20,000 letters to every coach at every level of college basketball, every player in the NBA, the WNBA, 800 retired players. I mean, we bombed them, just bombed them, knowing that you're going to get a 1 or 2% response. And so we out it goes, and the first response back comes from the women's basketball coach at the University of North Carolina in Asheville. Her name is Betsy Bloss. And I read this story, Ron, about a tournament game. Her dad had just died, and she tells this story about her father's voice as she's coaching this team. And his favorite expression, "Suck it up, Bets." In other words, when things get tough, "Suck it up, Bets." And I read this story, and I'm just sitting at my desk, and I'm weeping. And interestingly enough, the next week I had a speaking engagement in Asheville, and I tracked down this Betsy Bloss. I said, "Betsy, I want to meet you." And so she came over, and we had breakfast together. And I whispered in her ear. I said, "No matter how many stories come pouring through there, yours is going to make it." And there she is. I guarantee you, Ron, anybody who reads the Betsy Bloss story, "Suck it up, Bets," will end up in tears.
I know you have a wonderful story in here about, or at least from, Chris Paul. Would you please relate that one for us?
Well, what a story with Chris Paul. He's from Winston-Salem, North Carolina. Of course, he went to Wake Forest, and his grandfather, who ran a service station in Winston-Salem, was cruelly and unnecessarily murdered. And right after the murder took place, Ron, there was a high school game, and Chris played in the game despite his mourning, and he scores 61 points, I guess it was, and had a chance to go beyond his grandfather's age, and deliberately missed the free throw. Obviously, the game was wrapped up. But wanted to score the same number of points that his grandfather's age was, and deliberately missed that last free throw, you know, in a game that was already over, in a way to pay tribute to his grandfather. And Chris Paul is, you know, I'm a Wake Forest guy, Ron. He's one of my favorite players, even though he carves your heart out every time you face him. But there's one wonderful little story. His parents did a wonderful job of raising the Paul children, and no tattoos, no earrings, no jewelry. That was the rule. And Chris Paul's mother said, "When we get up in our home, the only person in this house putting on jewelry is going to be me."
You know, you had a player that played on your team before getting traded, and I got to know him very well. And I've got to say, in all the years that I've been doing sports, Pat, I would have to say he is the most interesting, most articulate, and I would even throw in the word fascinating, and I'm talking about Adonel Foye.
Oh, yes. Yeah, Adonel, and unfortunately, we made a deal, Ron, and for cap purposes, had to put him in the deal. And even though Adonel is at the end of his career and, you know, is sitting on our reserved list, you know, he's missed, even though he wasn't playing a lot. But what a guy. And his story's in here. This unbelievable story of this little kid, although he'd gotten big, down in one of the Caribbean islands, and he never played basketball, ends up going to a tournament somewhere and meets this couple from Colgate University and their son, who see this big guy, you know, 14 years old or whatever, and lead him off the island and bring him back to the United States and find a place for him in Philadelphia. He's all alone. And then they move him up to upstate New York, and he plays there and ends up going to Colgate and ends up being a first-round pick of the Warriors. I mean, what a story, Ron. And to hear Adonel tell it in that beautiful, lilting Caribbean accent, Oh, it's priceless. We're going to hear a lot more about O'Donnell after his career than during it.
Yeah, I was just going to say he is probably the most aware athlete that I have ever known. When he was in here the last time, he talked about becoming an American citizen because he's very interested in the political process. So
yes.
when you make that statement, I think you're absolutely right. We're going to see him in politics someplace.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess he can't run for president, right?
Right.
But he could run for governor. Or run for Senate, or I don't know what he's going to do, but we're going to hear an awful lot about O'Donnell Foyle. This is his second year with us. He's already written a couple of columns for the Orlando Sentinel,
mm-hmm.
you know, on the political view or what it means to be an American, or you know, the importance of voting. The guy just blows me away, and to have his story in here is just classic. It's a wonderful story about how this kid got off that island, and it was the game of basketball that did it for him. And he ends up with a degree from Colgate. He's working on his master's degree now, Ron. And he's had a 11, 12-year career?
Yes.
Not a great player. He turned basically a backup center. But listen, you play a decade in the NBA, that's not chopped liver.
Well, I remember talking to him when he came to Philadelphia, of course, with his guardian parents, and I asked him about going into a big city and about racism, and he said he never encountered it until he had gotten to Philadelphia, but he also said he had never been on an elevator before, and he said the first time he did and it went down, he jumped up before it got to the bottom floor.
this was a kid who had never left that island in the Caribbean. And suddenly they plant him in Philadelphia, and he ends up at a huge high school, Cardinal O'Hara, which was not best for him. And then the guardians, the professors at Colgate, brought him on up to upstate New York, and that's where he grew up. They basically adopted him.
Let me ask you a question, Pat. Have you found that the athletes that come out of certain schools, and I'm going to use Duke as the example because you know and I know Mike Krzyzewski, and you have a story in here from Grant Hill called The Fist.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering, do you find that they come out and are different as both people and players than I'm not trying to put down other schools, but I think the program like Duke is different than I think you find at some other schools.
Well, if you're going to end up with a Duke player, Ron, you know you're getting a smart kid, well-educated, who's been yelled at, you know, he's been disciplined. He's had to play in a system. You know that he's played on national television every night for 3 or 4 years, and you know that he's survived in that cauldron of ACC basketball. He's battle tested, and so anytime you get a Duke kid. Now the issue is, Ron, is the athletic ability. You know, is he a good enough talent? But the Shane Battiers and the Carlos Boozers and you know on and on. It's Grant Hill has probably been the most preeminent. Listen, Christian Laettner had a terrific career.
What is the story of The Fist about?
Well, when we picked up Grant as a free agent in 2000, I saw him in the weight room one day, and I said, Grant, what's your most vivid memory of playing for Coach K? And he thought for a minute, and he said, probably The Fist. And I said, well, explain that. He said, well, Coach K would hold his hand out, the five fingers, and he said, those five fingers represent a basketball team, but as a punching device, it's not very lethal, you know, if all five fingers are extended. But he said, bring it together with a fist. And he said, you have something really powerful. And then Grant said, but Coach K says if you remove one little finger, you've lost a lot of that fist. If the two fingers are extended again out of the fist, it's nothing again. But as long as you guys hold your fist together, you're a powerful force. And then to conclude it, Ron, when they break out of that huddle after a timeout, they never shout the word defense or they never shout the word win. The word they shout is always together.
Yeah,
and they flash the fist.
Well, I know in talking to Coach K, I was down there and I did my show with him one night. 600 people came out and sat on the back end of the deck of a sports bar, and I was just kind of blown away that that many people did. And I'll never forget, I asked him, I said, are you a goal setter? Because I would think that somebody like him would be. And he said, no, not at all. And I said, why is that? He said, well, let me give you an example, Ron. He said, what if I were to set a goal of winning 20 games and we win our first 20 games? What do I do after that? And I had never looked at it from that perspective. So I think he is a goal setter, but I think he is a goal setter in a different way. It's not so much numbers as much as it is, as you said, something like together.
He's a teacher at heart, Ron. Yes. And he's a leadership guy, and he's fascinating. I'm a big Coach K fan. And by the way, and he's done a number of books over the years, and they're all very, very good. He's got another one coming this spring that his daughter, you know, has helped craft for him. And it's basically about the whole Olympic experience and what happened this past summer and putting that team together and what went on. And I can't wait to read it.
Pat Williams is a basketball lifer who loves the game for its passion and meaning. Finally, along the way in my sports broadcasting career, I've made a lot of friends and met a lot of interesting people. No friend was more interesting than the late coach, Bill Walsh. I met him when he was coaching Stanford in the 70s, and I was the play-by-play announcer for the team. Our friendship continued through his NFL and Super Bowl winning years and after he retired. He's one of the most interesting people I've ever known. Aside from his close friends, few people really knew or understood Bill Walsh, the person. His son, Craig Walsh, knew him better than anyone and captured his dad's insight, wisdom, and life philosophy in the book The Score Takes Care of Itself, My Philosophy of Leadership. I asked Craig, at what point in growing up did he realize what his dad did for a living?
Well, I was a young lad. I knew he was a football coach, you know, growing up, and he wouldn't be there on the weekends because if it was college, Saturday you play your games, Sunday you break down the film, and if it was the NFL, you know, you're gone on Friday and you're back late Sunday. So I knew that his profession took him away for the weekend, and then I knew that there was a lot of work that went on at home. And my first experience with my father was he would bring home the tape. It wasn't tape, it was film back in those days, and a projector. And he'd run through the plays over and over again, and I would sit there with him, and he would watch the first step of everybody in the line of scrimmage and back it up, first step, back it up. And as a young lad, I thought, God, this is how you do it. I mean, you watch every step. And that's what he was doing. He was really looking at every player on the field, and I thought, wow, this football thing, there's a lot to it.
I might point out that Craig is the middle son, Steve was the oldest son, mm-hmm. and Elizabeth, of course, the one girl in the family, was the youngest in the family. How hard is it on children who happen to have parents that are in the limelight, or in this particular case, in sports?
Real tough. I mean, it is. I mean, you learn to take it on much like yourself. You know, the wins and losses are as difficult on the family as they are on your father. And you learn to live with it. I mean, you've got to go to school on Monday. If the team won, everybody's happy. And if they lost, everybody, you know, wants to know what happened. And you go through life that way. And it really kind of toughens you up a little bit and lets you know that, you know, everybody has a profession. Some are more in the limelight than others. And you really just have to make sure that you're comfortable with it.
You brought up a very interesting point, the transient nature of being a coach, where you're with one team one year and maybe the coaching staff gets fired or you move to another opportunity. How hard is that on a family?
It's tough. You don't know any better. You know, growing up, you think that's what everybody does. You know, it's not till you get in your older years and have children for yourself that you realize, you know, that there's another way. It was tough for us, my family. Heck, we were, my father was coaching for the Oakland Raiders, and then we were in Cincinnati. And then from Cincinnati, we went to San Diego, and I went from Indian Hill High School to La Jolla High School. Talk about a culture shock.
And also, I've always thought that women in the family never get enough credit. And I know your mom real well. She's a very strong personality. And I think that that's one of the things that really helped as far as keeping the family together and also making the family unit be able to work successfully. Am I correct about that?
Oh, yeah. God, for every successful coach, there's a strong woman. And anyone out there listening, you know, can attest to that, that when you come home, the last thing you're going to want to see is, you know, the wife or the children asking you what happened. You know, how did you lose? I mean, you want to have support. You want a hot cup of cocoa and a snack. You know, you don't want to be asked, you know, really what the heck happened out there.
Was it any different in the off season than it was during the season?
No, there's so much preparation on my father. You know, I worked for the 49ers for a number of years, you know, when he came back, you know, and what I might have saw there was a little different than he was there. I mean, he was one of these guys that just completely over-prepared. You know, he'd wake up in the middle of the night, and I'd hear that damn projector on, you know, and I knew what he was doing. He had thought of something, woke up, and wanted to double-check it, you know, and then he'd be most of the guys out there that worked for the organization knew in the 80s that he was the first one in and he was the first to leave. And players respected that. When they pulled their cars in the parking lot, there was my father's car, You know, and they put their hand on the hood to see how long he'd been there, and that thing was cold because he was in there preparing. You know, he had as much at stake as the players did, and it wasn't that he was the head coach and they were the players. He had a role to play, and everybody knew their roles, and his just happened to be head coach.
How did he deal with the professional frustration? Because he was supposed to have succeeded Paul Brown at Cincinnati as the head coach. Did not get that. Thought that after Prothro left San Diego that he was going to get the head coaching job there. Did not get an opportunity to be a head coach in the National Football League to 49 years old. How did he deal with that?
Tough. You know, it was tough. And in the book, we cover that extensively. You know, and there's all kinds of components that went into that. And one of them that people have to understand, and it really played out in the 80s with his success, is that my dad looked at the football field horizontally, not vertically. And this went against all the traditions of football. And now when you combine that with Paul Brown's thinking, when he established the Bengals, he'd come from a running world. He'd had Jim Brown and a number of others, and he thought north and south is how football's to be played, and my father didn't look at it that way. You know, he looked at the talent that the team had and adjusted a game plan around that talent, and a lot of times with the blocking schemes, they couldn't run the ball north and south. So they had to throw the ball, and he was out getting players like Ken Anderson from Augustana when there was all kinds of other players from Ohio State, Penn State, that were taken, you know, later. And that Paul Brown didn't understand those things and thought, gosh, this is my team. If I'm going to hand this thing off, you know, I'm still a traditionalist, and I want to see the Bengals be a traditionalist team.
Was it jealousy on Paul's part, afraid that maybe your dad would have more success than he did?
You know, I think that played into it a certain degree. But again, I think my dad's style, you know, he was so ahead of his time, you know, and Steve Jameson, the co-author of the book, and I, we sat down and thought, you know, what's a good analogy that we can use when we go to market this thing? And really what we came up with, he took the NFL from checkers to chess, you know, and that was his, he was cerebral. You know, he was no longer a coach that wouldn't allow players to have water. And gosh, if I didn't see a play, we're all going to run laps. You know, he was the furthest thing from that. You know, he knew players' comfort levels, and he was looking to get the most out of players on any given day. And that was his philosophy, and again, that went against the norms.
One of the things I often wondered about, and I never had a chance to talk to him about this, when he decided to take the Stanford job in 1977, I wondered what he did ego-wise that would allow him to take that. And I'm wondering also whether, if it had been any other school but Stanford, because of the academic relationship and knowing how cerebral, as you pointed out, your dad is, I wonder whether he would have been as comfortable about taking a coaching job, stepping back, not getting that NFL opportunity, since the NFL was primarily, aside from the early days, where he had kind of, you know, been as far as coaching.
Ron, understand, remember, you know, my dad's ego didn't get big till after that Super Bowl. any head coaching job was going to
be fabulous. He had a drive.
He did have a drive, but he felt, you know, hey, you know what? If I'm in charge, then I can showcase my abilities, you know, and if I'm going to be at Stanford for 10 years, or I'm going to be there for 3 years, it doesn't matter. I'm going to be able to showcase what I can do. And he would get so involved in coaching. You know, he was such a great teacher that, you know, he wanted to keep doing it. It was his hobby, it was his passion, and it was his profession.
One of the things that made him so successful is, and I recognized this very early in his career at Stanford, was he always dictated the tempo of the game. He went up against teams that were superior when it came to athletic talent, but he always knew how to find their weakness. And I thought that being at Stanford, where you had academically oriented athletes who were also students as well, he felt that he could take complicated things that maybe just pure athletes could not understand and apply it. Am I correct in that
observation? Ron, you are. You know, and I think a lot of it, what it is, and this is kind of in a military analogy also, you have to have buy-in. Your guys have to believe in what you're trying to do. And at Stanford, that was the perfect environment because the guys could see what we're going to do. You know, we're going to start practice on Monday. We're playing USC. We're going to say, look, UCLA or USC, they're a better team than we are. They've got better athletes. Their coaches have been around long. You know, how are we going to beat these guys? Well, we're going to have to create an approach, and you guys have to believe in it. And then over the week, the course of practice, they would install things. This is how we're going to do it, guys, because they do this, we're going to do this. And then you get a buy-in. So they start that game thinking, hey, we're equal. Where, you know, instead of we got to get lucky guys to win this thing, and that was really one of his approaches. And when you look at the plays that he would script, the players all knew the plays going into the locker room before the first play of the game. This was in college, and this was in the NFL. And guys, we're going to do this and see how they react. And if they react this way, we're going to change it and we're going to do this. And it was complicated. You know, and again, if you got the guys to buy into it, you could make changes and they were readily acceptable.
What did he enjoy most about coaching college football?
Just the guys, the attitude. I mean, there weren't any egos. The guys played for the love of the game. You know, they really did, and they still do. You know, and there's enough guys in the NFL that still play that way also, that it wasn't anything about the money. A lot of them, the only way they were going to go to college was on a scholarship. So they were so happy, and their families were happy, and the families really wanted them to succeed. You know, my dad spent a lot of time on the phone with parents, talking to them about their sons, you know, and how they're doing in school, and it's important for the parents to call and check in. And he just loved the enthusiasm and the effect that the kids wanted to learn. They were in a learning environment, and they came to football practice like they were going to chemistry. They wanted to learn something, and they wanted to apply it.
Craig Walsh is with us. And again, if you'd like to check out this book, I recommend it. The Score Takes Care of Itself, My Philosophy of Leadership, about his dad, the late Bill Walsh. Why did you write this book?
You know what? Somebody had to put it down. You know, I was heartbroken when my father passed away. I took 6 months off my career to be with my father, to take him to his treatments. You know, it was an agonizing process for he and I, because he knew this was it. I knew this was it. And somehow he and I had to make small talk at the beginning. I would take him into his treatments at Stanford, and what was actually keeping him alive was transfusions. And here was a man that had really relied on himself only, and now he was being kept alive through a process. Now, it was difficult for him. I was fortunate, but yet unfortunate, to sit down and plan his service step by step with him. I mean, he told me who he wanted to be there and what we wanted to talk about and the venue, and right down to the color of the flowers. And I executed his plan.
One of the things that I came away with, because I had lunch with him, one of his former players, Spencer Tillman, flew up from Houston. I picked Spencer up at the airport, and we had lunch just off the Stanford campus. And it was probably about two and a half months before he passed away. And we talked about old times, and I could see how proud he was of Spencer. But I also felt that the whole experience he went through toward the end of his life humanized him in a way that I don't think anything else could have, because he got close. He opened up. He showed his emotions to people that he really cared for, but I don't think he felt he could show them those emotions when he was alive, and especially when he was a coach. Am I correct?
Oh, very much so, Ron. His style of motivation was simple. He demanded more than you were willing to offer. And this is where he got into a rub with a number of players on the team that weren't used to being motivated this way. You know, I can talk about Ronnie Lott. He and I are good buddies these days, and we do All-Stars Helping Kids in New York, and it's a fabulous program that Ronnie has. But I'm not saying my father pressed his buttons, but my father demanded more from Ronnie. Ronnie thought that he was already in fifth gear, and my dad wanted sixth gear. And he pushed him toward it, and Ronnie achieved it. Ronnie was grateful to my father at the end, and we talk about this in the book, that you know, no one's ever going to come back to you after your career and say, God, thanks for taking it easy on me. You know, my father had a unique ability to motivate people and get the most out of them, and that's not being their friend. Let's be honest.
I thought Joe Montana made an interesting comment in the foreword in the book, and I'm just going to quote from it. He says his mind for technical football was extraordinary. But beyond that, his ability to organize and manage his staff, players, everybody, to get the whole organization on exactly the same page. And I thought that that's unique. That's an awfully difficult thing to do when you have different personalities, different agendas, different abilities as well. How was your dad able to do that?
Well, we talk about it in the book. Again, you've got to get out and read this thing. It was all about hiring the right people from the beginning, you know, and we go back to Ed DeBartolo. We talk about him in the book. He gave my dad enough latitude to hire the right people. And so he wasn't stuck with a process. You know, you see a lot of NFL teams, a lot of professional sports organizations, even in college, that they're put together crazily. The head coach is hired second, and then the defensive coordinator is hired from somebody else. You get a general manager that somebody else has hired. And these people never knew each other 6 months ago, but now they're supposed to win a Super Bowl. And my dad was fortunate enough to get the right people that thought the way he thought. And he had worked with these people before and knew that they would either buy into his methods or could learn how to buy into his methods.
One of the other things that Joe said in the book and in the foreword, which I found fascinating, he taught us to hate mistakes. And I'm wondering how he did that. He could yell and he could get upset and he could be very pointed. And I know he had a great sense of humor. But when you have a standard and you want everybody else to live up to it, how that must have driven him crazy sometimes.
Well, it went past the stink eye. The stink eye was level one and we were probably operating at level eight. It was just pure coldness. I mean, it was turn your back. I mean, when you made a mistake, you know, you certainly knew you made a mistake. And you know, all you could do was learn from those mistakes. And mistakes weren't tolerated. I mean, they really shot for excellence. And if they just missed excellence, then they were pretty damn good. And, you know, some teams just shoot for completing the pass, turning up field and running 10 yards. You know, the 49ers went way past that.
Russ Francis, Hacksaw Reynolds, and you're smiling because you know what I'm talking about as far as personality. There were guys that are on the other side of the moon, and here is a man that's on the other side who's cerebral, doesn't like mistakes. How did he deal with the individuality that he had to deal with to get everybody on the same page?
It's all about buy-in, and it starts in training camp. You know, again, you know, I think a lot of the 49ers' successes really started when they were up in Rockland, California. It was a hot area located in the foothills. You'd get in those little valleys, it'd get warm, it'd be 110 degrees outside, and they'd be putting on stinky, sweaty, wet pads. and you looked around, and you wondered who would be with us at the end. You know, it was tough. It was training. And when you finally got to the air-conditioned locker room in Santa Clara, California, and you had a beautiful oak locker, and you had guys handing you towels, you knew that you'd been through something to get to this. So even before you played your first game, you had climbed a huge mountain, and you had made the San Francisco 49ers. Now, you know, you just have the team all practices in their facilities, and guys are coming out. You're bringing portable lockers in, and there's a pecking order, who gets in the shower. So, you know, I think it all starts in training. You know, guys have to be able to bond together early on and go through something before they can become something.
The other thing about him that I think was a dichotomy and that a lot of people did not expect, and I think this is important in business as well, is the fact that he had a sense of humor. And it usually came out at a time you did not expect it. I mean, there's a story in this book about what he did with the coaches, what he made the coaches do, because he wasn't happy or he didn't want to see his players go on road trips not looking a certain way. Tell the story.
Well, he came in. He got the coaches, and they got together. You know, things slowly but surely degrade down. It starts with one guy wearing a pair of high-heeled boots, and then it starts with a guy wearing bell-bottoms, and this guy's got a puka chain on, and then the guy wears the floppy hat, and pretty soon the whole damn team is trying to outdo each other. So he came in and got the coaches. They wore a bunch of outfits. One guy came in tights. One guy was in a, you know, all crazy outfits, and they just showed up canned and walked into a meeting wearing these crazy clothes, and the obviously the team knew exactly where the coaches were coming from as far as dress, and all my dad really had to say was clean it up. And the next day, you know, you had guys wearing more traditional clothes around as they traveled.
I always thought that everything he did in life, whether it be on the football field or even outside of it, he did with measure, meaning that he thought about it before he actually did it. Am I correct?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was very well thought out. I mean, he was the gatekeeper. It was up to him to think of the minutia and then pass that minutia on to be solved, the problems. And that's how he really ruled, you know, being the head coach. I mean, I don't want to say ruled, but everybody looked to Bill. I mean, that was my father. They looked to him, you know, Bill, how are we going to win this thing? Give us our marching orders. And then he would come up with something, and there was a vetting process. My dad wasn't the person that wouldn't listen to anybody. You know, it was tough. I mean, you had to really build a case, but if you had a better way to do it, he'd listen to you.
I often wonder how leaders, and Bill being a leader, deal with self-doubt, because it's pretty well known that in those early days of the 49ers, a team that was 2-14, he just said, what the hell have I done? What have I taken over? And Dick Vermeil, his very, very good friend, I heard the story from Norv Turner that when Dick was at Philadelphia, that Dick would be getting ready to go into his team meetings with the Eagles, and he'd be about 20 minutes late because he was on the phone with Bill saying, what the heck happened? What am I doing here? How do I get over this? As far as leadership goes, and your dad in particular, you know, how do leaders deal with self-doubt?
Well, you know, no leader's hatched out of an egg. Some guys think they're leaders because they were all state fullbacks or something, or they went to Annapolis, or they went to some of the other schools, but it's not the case. You have to be a leader. You have to learn through experience. You have to have failed to become a leader. You have to learn from your mistakes. And everywhere my dad was, he learned. He learned from Sid Gilman. He learned from Tommy Prothrow. Heck, Paul Brown. I mean, he worked from Al Davis. I remember when my father was coaching for Al Davis, Al would be at home, and he would call the facility and say, okay, coaches, now you can go home. And it'd be 10 o'clock at night. And my father learned from that that's not what you do to your coaches. Nothing against the organization of the Raiders, but he learned that's not what you do. So when it came to making a decision in self-doubt, you have to go with your gut, and it has to be calculated. You know, you have to take the mystery out of your decision, you know, and that is a vetting process that goes through preparation.
Bill Walsh, an interesting man, remembered by his appreciative son, Craig Walsh. I hope you've enjoyed World Airways in-flight presentation of Sports Byline USA, and you'll listen to our live broadcasts on radio, the American Forces Network worldwide, Sirius Satellite Radio Channel 122, and the Internet. If you'd like a listing of Sports Byline's radio affiliates, be sure to check out our award-winning website at sportsbyline.com. I'm Ron Barr, and thanks for being a part of America's sports talk show, Sports Byline USA.